It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Ooh, I don't have time to do a full hello or a full intro because we ran way overboard on this recording. We were joined by entertainment.ie's Brian Lloyd. He's the movie editor over there, and he's a big fan of this film, Excalibur, so I thought we'd get him on for a chat about it. And then I forgot that he's much like myself and Kevin, that if you wind him up, he's very willing to just keep going until someone forcibly hits the stop recording button. I've already edited down like 15 or 20 minutes of this episode. And I know some of you are thinking, because you've watched the film, you're like, how could you talk for 2 hours about Excalibur? Well, it's because in between we talk about Die Hard and Harry Potter and Fast and the Furious and just an absolute bunch of other things. Because, you know, tangents. Who doesn't like tangents? Speaking of tangents, well, it's not a good segue. I just want to segue into saying that we've got live gigs coming up. We're going to be down in Cork, in Collins, or Cocklands, however you pronounce it, on the 4th of March with the wonderful Roger O'Sullivan. And you can find tickets for that on the Collins website. And if you want to go check us out in Belfast, where we're going to be performing on the 10th in the Sunflower with local comedian special guest Jordan Robinson. And you can get those tickets on Eventbrite. Just type in Shite Talk Belfast. And we're releasing this episode of the Film Club free for the listeners and not behind the paywall as usual, because it's probably a good idea to give people a sample of what we're going to be doing once a month behind the paywall. So if you enjoy this, then sure, go sign up to the Patreon and you'll have access to our film clubs, our live episodes that we record, some of the bonus content we put up just for there, and then as well as like all of the special content that we put up that we can't legally put out because we would be sued, and some other fun bits and pieces. So yeah, go check that out if you enjoy this, and we'll be talking to you next week with the regular episode, and which will be the last of the season, of the regular season. So that is a good time to sign up for the Patreon, because if you miss hearing us, well, we'll still be putting up about 3 or 4 episodes a month on that anyway. So yeah, cheers. Shafter, chat to you soon. Hello, and welcome to Shite Talk, an Irish history podcast. I've realised, is that the first time I've had to do the hello in front of other people?
Yeah, no, I'm just laughing at how long it's gotten.
Yeah, it's the podcast started with like the first couple of episodes years ago with Kevin saying, hello and welcome to Shite Talk. And one of my friends said, I really like it when he does that. So I stole it. And it's been getting like progressively longer.
Yeah. I dig it. Okay, I get
and
that.
And it's good for Halloween. You can do like, there's so many plays on it for different times of the year.
Just it. You started doing it for Halloween last year and it hasn't stopped.
Well, like, I mean, I could see it for like Christmas being going like, hello, ho, ho, ho.
That's exactly what he did. That is exactly what he did.
There you go. Yeah. I can see it. Yeah.
That's two events. What are you going to do for Valentine's Day?
Hello,
ho. Ho, 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 ho.
There you go.
Yeah. And then for like Paddy's Day, you could go, hello, ho, ho. Because it's Paddy, and it's kind of like, you know, Paddy Wackery.
Yeah, to, and he'll sell out his country.
I have no problem with that. Buddy, I'm like Saoirse Ronan on SNL.
She really did, though.
Oh, yeah.
That was such...
Fair play to her.
Oh, no, well done. Fair play to the... Like, can respect the hustle of it, but at the same time, way
how,
to...
Yeah, mm. How did she say her name was pronounced?
Because I know my Saoirse friend... like inertia.
Yeah, Saoirse. Like inertia.
Like inertia. And I know that because I had to cover that for the site that you and I used to work
on. Oh, so we'll do the introduction because we haven't said the name of the voice who's on
or
here.
What's happening.
Yes.
You just said the word and then we went off on a rant now. But there's a third voice here.
Yes, it's entertainment.ie's Brian Lloyd. Hello, Brian.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. I haven't seen you for about, what, three, 4 years?
3, 4 years, I think, was the last time you and I were in a room together, yeah. Yeah, no, it's very nice to be here. Thanks very much for having me. It is. Very much appreciated. Well, I'm a first time listener, first time guest, and thanks for having me on.
Of course. You actually picked the film from our long list that the fans have sent in, and I want to know why in God's name you did this to me.
Yeah.
Right. So the film I picked was Excalibur, John Borman's Excalibur from 1981, filmed around Ireland, filmed in Wicklow, filmed in Tip, filmed in your locality of Carlow.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you from?
Dundalk. I don't think they made it up that
far. I don't think they made it up that far. But yeah, I love... Now, the two of yous, before we came on, yous were both saying, God, this film is absolutely terrible.
Mm.
Well, in fact, you use expletives, and I wasn't sure. Am I allowed
to? Oh, no, yeah. Oh,
okay, great. So go. Yeah. So you said it was total bollocks, and yous are talking bollocks, because this film is great. Okay, and you just don't know how to watch it properly.
Well, see, I said it to him, because we ended up, myself and Jason watched the first half of it together, and I was watching it, and I was like, yeah, fucking, there is a good story in here. There's a good film in here. And then I realized, oh, it's obviously based on the fucking Arthurian legend, so it is a good story. And it looks beautiful. There's so many cool sets in it. There's so many cool shots in it. By God, what a piece of garbage.
All right, okay, now, what I will say, I will defend it up to a point.
Yeah. Had they not got any acting classes in Carlow at the time?
None. And like, that's the thing of it. Like, my wife refers to it as that shouting film.
Oh, yeah. Because
everyone is just shouting.
Well, yes.
Was it meant to be like a production kind of based on like a stage play?
Because
facial movement's very big. Everyone's screaming.
Yeah.
It feels like you're just watching a play.
Yes, everyone is basically acting for the person at the end of the... And like, to be fair, I think that is what John Borman was going for. He really was going for this operatic quality. And like, you look at the cast, like, you know, Ciarán Hinds and Liam Neeson, that was like some of their first films, and they were just coming out of like the Abbey Theatre.
Yeah, Liam Neeson looked fucking...
Oh, he looked insane. He looked like an embryo.
I would not have guessed that was him.
Yeah, no, he really doesn't... It doesn't look like him at all.
No.
Like, I have it on my notes list of things I liked and things I didn't like. One of the things I really didn't like, how much makeup Liam Neeson's wear.
Yeah, they were all wearing a lot of makeup.
He's so red in the cheek, so rosy. It doesn't really make sense when he's fighting someone to the death.
And like Gabriel Byrne as well, like he's like very, very tanned and very swarthy looking almost. Mm-hmm. And you're like, did you go on like a Spanish holiday or something before you came and did this? Like, what's going on there?
Play an old English.
Yeah, because like you're meant to be like, he's meant to be like this sort of like mythic English figure, but he looks like he just stepped off the plane from like Fuengirola or something like that. He looks great.
No, this is that, because this was his first film.
Oh, yeah, was it?
I think, yeah, because he had just come off, like, the Reardons or something like that, or one of those old RTE shows.
Yeah. Now, this is probably jumping into the bit we would do at the end, but you know who else's first film it was? And I just read this morning. Boardman's daughter played...
Yes. Yeah. He has three
Ingrid?
Kids.
Ingram?
Yeah.
Basically, the woman who...
Gets violently raped.
Well, yeah. So yes. Her only role in the film is just getting her tits out, getting raped, and then that's it. And that's the only film she's ever done.
She dances.
And that was the director's daughter. She sure does dance.
Very provocatively.
She sure does dance. Oh, yeah. My God.
What the hell was that about?
Again, this is the thing I really, really do love about this film is that, you know, when you think of kind of sword and sorcery kind of films up to this point, they were very much kind of like done in a kind of way that was very stagey, yes, but in a very austere manner. Like, it was very proper. There was no sort of primalism about it. There was no...
No scenes where you saw a man in full armor penetrate
a
naked woman.
Like, yeah, okay, fine, yeah. Like, there was no sex in it, basically.
Sure.
They were very, very sexless.
Yeah.
And what kind of... I think what John Borman was trying to evoke was this idea of, like, this is when... And they keep kind of reference it. Merlin keeps saying in the film, like, when the world was young kind of thing. So there's this idea of, like... society and civilization hasn't really formed yet. People are still animals. People are still, you know, running around with armor, and they're still doing it in armor and stuff like that. So, like, the idea of all the emotions in the film are really, really primal. Like that bit when she's dancing and the lads are all like banging the table with their swords.
Out of time with
each other. Out of time. And it's almost like you can see their table kind of rising from the feckin' erections that they've got. Like,
the alliance.
Yeah. And like everyone is screaming at the table.
At each other.
Yeah. And like even when he like that, he does the horrible thing where he like slits his wrist and then.
Yeah, like a blood oath. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. It's like, it's very like, I it's so ridiculous as to be over the top and comical, but I kind of appreciate that they were doing something that hasn't been done before and hasn't really been replicated since. Now, that might be because it was shit.
Yeah.
You think it was shit, but I think it was because nobody's had the balls to to follow something
to
like
cast
this.
Their daughter in a sex
well, because when it cuts back to those guys when they are clamming on the table, they're all sort of, they don't know where to look. They're all awkward. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, well, that's his fucking daughter right there.
Yeah.
That guy who's shouting action and you're looking at his daughter running around. She's fucking looking anywhere but at her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very... And again, like, I mean, his son to... we're jumping way ahead now, but like Charlie Borman was the young son who like gets... very weirdly oiled up by Helen Mirren.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was John Borman's son. So, like, it's very...
He's a family man.
Too much of a family man. Now,
no, but so that was him. It's when he was the younger version of him.
Sorry, yes.
Yeah, so it is... Yeah. Because they do a lot of time skipping throughout the film where it's just like, okay, here's Arthur as a baby. Merlin's taking him away. Yeah. And then it's a hard cut to 17 years later. Well, and the... no text on screen to say it's been this long.
Yeah.
Well, by and large, I found the film, like... very difficult to follow.
Yes.
It's unintelligible, a lot of it. But when we were talking about, like, your wife calls this the shouting film, in one of the jump cuts, in order to... I can't remember the guy who plays Arthur's... the actor's name.
I can't... Nigel Curry... Nigel Terry.
Nigel Terry. In order to show the time has passed, he just starts shouting.
Yeah.
In one scene, he's shouting, and then they're like, oh, he's a man now. This is... Yeah. He was the only one who wasn't shouting for the half hour.
It was a cool call to go, right, three different generations.
Yeah.
You're going to play every single version of yourself. Like, he's meant to be, he's 35 in real life when he's playing, like, Arthur.
As a 17-year-old. Yeah. Or and a 15-year-old.
There's him, although I find this with a lot of older films, but there's two characters anyway. There's him and one of the other knights, where they just shout, like, all the supporting cast, like, boy, get that boy out of here. It's like, that's a fucking man. Like, that's...
Yeah.
The only difference between him and the other men is that you're calling him boy.
Yeah.
And that's... Yeah. And then, same actor, starts shouting, like, oh, he's a man now.
It's very, like, yeah, and I wonder, kind of, like, you know, because it was shot in Ireland, like, they had to use, basically, every actor that was available. And if you had a pulse, and you had a screenshot, you had a headshot... Boom, you're in Excalibur.
Yeah, acting talent.
Oh, it's like Emmett Scanlon and crime dramas.
Okay.
Oh, there's every time I turn on RTE, there's a new trailer for like an upcoming crime drama.
Yeah.
And he's a policeman.
That's
every single one of them. Yeah. And it's like, is he dodgy or is he not?
He's walking around the Docklands, the pissings of rain, looking angry. Emmett Scanlon is...
Great mustache. Mustache man.
Mustache man in the Docklands. But this was... in the same way that, like, if there was a crime drama being made now, you'd have Emmett Scanlon or you'd have somebody from Love Hate in the 80s, rather. If you were an Irish actor, you were in Excalibur. And there's, like, so many actors that are in it, like. And, you know, I think... It's hard for me to criticize it a bit because it's like...
I could help you there.
But like, I mean, no, in the sense of like, I'm glad like that such a wacky, ridiculous film was made in Ireland. Like, you look at like, there was another John Borman film, like Zardoz.
I put it on the list for this podcast now because I didn't know about it. And I saw some stills of your man on the beach, basically looking like Borat, like his man thong.
Yeah.
But it's like red.
Sean Connery. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sean Connery wearing a red nappy running around Dollymount Strand.
Yeah, I don't know how we didn't know about this.
Like, it sounds amazing.
Yeah.
It's so, like, it is basically, like, imagine you've done a shit ton of LSD and then you get, like, a load of cameras and you have Sean Connery and you're running around Wicklow filming stuff. That's basically what Zardoz is. It is so nuts. It is so bonkers. And I have such a great love for Zardoz and for Excalibur because... It was made in Ireland at a time when there was such a huge amount of conservatism in every aspect of life, in social, in sexual, in political, in religion, it just everything. And like, there was John Borman just being like, fuck all he is, I'm gonna put Sean Connery in a thong and I'm gonna have my daughter having a very rough sex scene with this guy and with Gabriel Byrne, who you knew from the Reardons, the most, you know, middle of the road, middlebrow drama.
That's before my time, though. I don't know. No,
before my time as well, but like, I know of it. Like, I've seen, like, it was basically like Fair City before Fair City. Yeah. Actually, come to think of it, I think it's a prequel of Glen Rowe. I'm a little bit older than you, but I'm not that, you know.
I've heard of these things, but I've never seen any of them.
Yeah, I think like Glen Rowe was like this.
Glen Rowe was the country version of Fair City.
Yeah,
and
basically. The Reardons
was the prequel to Glen Rowe.
Okay, yes, yeah. It was when there was two channels on TV.
Yeah,
which is what everyone in Ireland watched.
Yeah, and Heartbeat.
Yes. Yeah,
we didn't make that, but it's still on every day.
Yeah,
yeah.
My dad watches at 8 o'clock every day. Misses that, gets the next day 6 o'clock.
Is Heartbeat still going?
No, but I don't think so.
It must be repeats now.
Yeah. But they have like 400 episodes.
Yeah, no, it's insane. Like Nick Berry was just
they were pumping out like 30-40 a year every year for 20 something years.
Yeah.
Will we start at the start of the film and try and describe it the whole way through? It starts off. Like, it's fair enough that it probably relies on you to know a little bit about some of the Arthurian legend stories.
Yeah.
Because it does not hold your hand
toward
anything. So the first scene is, again, the costume designs, they're amazing. It looks class. But there's a battle. It's unintelligible. You don't know who is fighting who. They all look the same.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur shows... Oh, no, not Arthur. Merlin shows up. Uther's there. And he's shouting about a sword. And there's talk about Excalibur. But no one really says why.
Yeah.
No one says what that is or why it's good. No. And it just seems to be a regular sword.
And they're having a full-blown conversation in the heat of the battle.
Yeah, yes. On different sides of a field.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And that's probably one of the only times they're not... They are screaming, but they're not screaming as loudly.
No.
Yes.
There's like a lot of that where you're like, why is it this scene? They're just not going to... Like, randomly you'll just find that where it's just the energy drops.
Yeah.
And then comes back hard again.
Yeah. It's like, can we put some shouting in here? Let's get a horse in here. Will the horse make you shout? Yeah.
Oh, the dings when the swords hit, like the metal armor.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's so over the top.
It's so ridiculous. Like... I think like you were saying there, like the kind of the chaos of it or whatever. Again, I think that kind of goes to the whole sort of the primalness of it all, that like it was man versus man. Nobody knew who was on each other's side and everyone was just fighting. But then out of that chaos came the idea of a unified king and the idea of England or Great Britain or whatever being unified under one sword, Excalibur. And the idea was that Excalibur was basically a sort of a stand-in for the idea of Christianity, really, and like the idea of like what we would now call civilization, the idea of like one person rules all.
Because
I mean, like, John Borman wanted to do Lord of the Rings for ages.
Yes. Yeah, I was reading that.
Yeah, and he couldn't get the rights from Tolkien, so he said, right, well, screw you then. I'm just going to make my own version of it.
Yeah.
And the way that he kind of refers to Excalibur is kind of like how he refers to the One Ring, because it's like... Yeah, because it can be used to destroy, but it can also be used to unify, and it's up to... Its power itself is basically defined by whoever wields it. Like, it can be used for good or it can be used for evil. Like,
but crying shame that we don't have a John Borman
Lord
of the Rings. Oh, because that would be crazy.
Yeah. Keep it secret. Keep it safe.
The alliance.
Yeah.
The fellowship.
Like, how would the Frodo and Samwise scenes, how would they go with John Borman? Like, you know, that kind of way. That whole homoeroticism is kind of just like bubbling under the surface, like John Borman, get him in there. What's he gonna do with it?
Well, they wouldn't have any young looking boy. They're 45-year-old men playing Frodo. But it's a shame. Yeah, he could have taken the leaf out of Peter Jackson's book. Because if you made this into three films instead of one insane, because the whole starting bit is just setting up Arthur's birth.
Yeah.
But that goes on for like half an hour. And that is a whole story itself.
Yeah,
But it's just sort of tacked on. And this is where you see John Boardman's daughter. And so, yeah, but the basic plot of that bit is that because it goes really quickly.
Mm.
You see them fight, then you see the truce. Then immediately the truce is broken because he sees his wife. And they're all with through this film because the theme comes up a good
he
bit.
He points at him, though. He pokes the bear because he's like, you can have all the... Yeah, you can be the king, you have your money, you can do whatever, but you'll never have my wife. And he's like, I will have your wife. Like, that. The timing for that is hilarious. Where it's everyone smashing the table, and then he just, like, it's too much for him, and it's like, so ferocious. And he's like, okay, I got it, I'm sorry. I just got it. I really tried there. I know I just cut my wrist and, like, did a blood oath, like, 30 seconds ago, but I'm going to need to fuck her.
I'm going to need a bust nut on your wife. I'm very, very sorry. But I'm now going to have to, like, smash your castle up now. I'm very, very sorry.
It immediately, cuts to siege scenes.
Yeah.
And him, the, not Uther, the other king, just standing there, stone-faced, as, like, firebombs are coming out.
Yeah.
Give a shit. But, well, because it happens a few times in the films, but they don't say...
Why?
They don't say why to anything, but they also never say, like, writing or anything. It's always very... colorful, where they're like, I would just one embrace from her, that's all I need, and then you're supposed to fuck her, as he does a couple of scenes later. But so he, because this happens a lot where they just see someone for a second. Even Lancelot says it later on, where he's like, you know, Guinevere, I she is my love, but Arthur is my best friend. So you've fucking met both of them 10 minutes ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What have you been doing your whole life?
You know, love at first sight.
Yeah.
Sure. It can exist.
Between maybe. Men and kings.
I don't know, you're both in relationships. I'm not.
And I'm using this a lot to defend it. Like, but again, it goes to that thing of like primal urges and primal kind of like, it's not refined. It's not civilized. There's no sort of like analysis can be put to it. Like, it's just like, I want to fuck her. I've just seen her. I'm in love with her. That guy slighted me. I'm going to kill him.
Yeah.
You know.
Actually, putting it like that, it's not that over the top. It's genuinely how love actually is. Like,
yeah, it can be. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So he gives up the alliance through some shouting. They go into a siege. He calls on Merlin, who, as a character in the first bit of the film, at some point, maybe it is the whole truth and I just didn't notice, but at some point he just turns into like a wacky...
Yeah.
I don't know what way they were trying to play him, because at the start he's a very serious wizard, and about an hour into it, he's just like a goofball. He gets bonked on the head, he's tree-stooging it around the place.
Yeah.
I don't know. What's the crack with that?
Direction? I genuinely don't know, because like that actor, like he's so committed on different points that I can never really... And maybe it's the whole thing of like, you know, he's meant to be like an unreliable narrator or something like that. As in like, you don't know if he's serious or not. Yeah. You don't know if he's there to help Uther or help Arthur.
Mm.
And that he kind of even says it himself, I come and go as I please kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, and that's kind of like, again, to go back to Lord of the Rings,
it's the Gandalf figure.
Exactly.
That's what you were saying yesterday, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He's basically just a stand-in for Gandalf. And like the whole thing about Gandalf is that he's never late, nor is he early. He arrives exactly when he means to. But in Merlin's case, it's like, I'm not here to help you. I'm just here to help, you know, the land and the earth. I don't serve you, I serve them kind of thing.
Yeah.
So...
Which is similar to Gandalf as well.
Yeah.
And Gandalf does have like comedic moments.
Completely.
In the film where he's just... I was saying to Jay, like one of my favorite bits in that whole trilogy of films is when they're going to see Theoden and Gandalf is just like, you know, they're taking their swords off them and say, oh, you wouldn't separate an old man from his walking stick.
Yeah.
And they leave it and he just gives Aragorn the cheekiest like wink. Like he's just after sneaking a nag into Hopper. He's just like, wait, watch this. Like that. And that's great. So it's sort of similar then with Merlin, where they're kind of, they sort of jump around a bit.
But obviously...
How serious he's supposed to be.
Yeah, but then because it's John Borman, because it's the 70s, and because it's this film, it's everything amped up to 20.
Yes.
Like, he's not just a little bit coy and a little bit funny. He's full on, as you say, Three Stooges doing the whole thing, like falling, like trying to catch a fish and falls over kind of stuff. Like,
oh, falls into the
complete
river.
Complete pratfall.
Yeah.
Total physical comedy, like just yucking it up. Like.
And there's, I can't remember the young knight. It's a bit where he goes in, like literally swings something around and bonks him on the head.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I don't know.
It's total, like, and like, again, like, I understand why people hate it or dislike it, because it's so, it moves so sharply, it's so extreme from one to the other. Yes. But I love that it's like so balls out at every point, that it's like, yeah, if we're gonna do comedy, we're gonna literally do slapstick comedy. Yeah, if we're gonna do violence, we're literally gonna have people's heads cut off. Mm. If we're gonna have a sex scene, it's gonna be very, very explicit.
Yeah.
There's no in between.
No,
here.
Yeah, like in the battle scenes, how many times do you see the close up of just arms being cut
off?
Yeah, and then like just it's pretty bad prop blood that just like squirts out.
Oh no, it's ridiculous. Yeah. But like it's, and like again, like I can see why people kind of compare it to something like Monty Python, because it is ridiculous, and to the point of being comedic. Like,
yeah, well, there's one, yeah, some scene, maybe it's a dream sequel, but Lancelot gets stabbed.
Yeah,
and like
it's
the sword looks it whatever way. Yeah, the sword looks great going through him, but then when it comes out, it's like someone just colored him in with a crayon.
Yeah,
like a red patch.
It's like he's got a little bit of like it's like somebody just opened up one of those little satchels of tomato sauce and just rubbed it on there. Like there you go, that's good enough.
I realize this is going back on what I just said a minute ago, but you know, Guinevere falling in love with Lancelot on first sight, I can see it. There's a healthy bit of, that's a healthy hunk of man there.
Oh yeah,
and just remembering that scene, you get a good big arse.
Oh yeah, he looks like Superman. Like he's got the jawline. Yeah, yeah. Like I mean, look at Larrather. Like I mean, he's like such a wimp at the best of times.
He's
like,
but what's the right? So we get the original stone Merlin at the start. Uther convinces him to help him win the siege, although he's not really trying to win the siege. He's just trying to fuck John Boardman's daughter. And so then, so they come up with this convoluted plan where they lure Gabriel Byrne's character out of the castle, and Merlin will change Uther to look like Gabriel Byrne.
No, Gabriel Byrne's going. Gabriel Byrne is Uther.
Yeah.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's Corin Redgrave. Oh, it's the Duke of Cornwall. Yeah.
Okay. So so he's going to change what he looks like so that he can get into the castle and fuck his wife.
Yeah.
It's very Revenge of the Nerds.
It is. Yeah.
It's a dodgy subject. Battered. They do that in Harry Potter, and one of them, when they take the potion and they like to turn into the two Slytherin guys.
Yeah.
But they're not going to like
have sex with somebody who they don't realize it's that person.
That definitely would have been happening all over the place in Harry Potter.
I'm sure it would.
Yeah.
It seems like maybe I'm just really cynical of people, but like if you've got that ability, you know, how is that not being used for some pretty dodgy and heinous stuff.
I can understand why the films made these choices, but like realistically, there would have been a lot more sexual hijinks in it.
Definitely. And even that whole thing, like, did you see that thing of like J.K. Rowling made a whole, actually wrote an entire explanation of how to get rid of poo.
Oh yeah.
In the Ministry of Magic, it's literally magicked away.
Yeah.
Why would you even need to know that? Who the fuck knows?
Surely they
who
have.
Who cares?
But they have toilets. Like
yeah.
Because it's not like the rest of the magic world doesn't have toilets. So they, obviously, like Hogwarts has them. You see them. Like Harry goes into them. Like, so they don't, why would they magic away? Why wouldn't you magic away?
I suppose,
why would you invent plumbing if you can just be like,
bye. Yeah. Just boom. And it just disappears.
I did see the other day Robert Pattinson saying that the reason he held his wand so weird in Harry Potter was because he was like, to hold it like a wand, it seems stupid. I'm going to hold it like a gun.
Yes.
That's fucking cool.
Yeah.
And it is cool.
And he was
fucking,
right.
The way Ralph Fiennes holds it as Voldemort, where he's just like, he fucking balancing it on a finger at all times. And there's a scene, it's one of these, I don't know, weird dream scenes where Voldemort's getting into Harry's head. And there's just like cuts of Ralph Fiennes just being like, just doing like fucking kiss poses. And he's just like rock and roll. It's so bizarre.
And kind of to go back to Excalibur, like I think, like, you know, Excalibur like has influenced a lot of like, you know, British fantasy films, like, and kind of, you know, British kind of like epics. Like, I mean, definitely, like there are scenes, not full scenes, but like that sort of operatic quality or whatever, that's definitely present in a lot of like the Harry Potter films.
Yeah.
And like even something like The Green Knight, which was out recently enough.
Oh, sure.
Like that's very similar to Excalibur. Like.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But so you're saying then, to go back to what you were talking about earlier on, that this is probably one of the first mainstream films that have like fantasy time period crossed over with a bunch of violence and sex.
Yeah.
So like this is... It's not just like just easy to throw it out and go like, all right, it's like a precursor to Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about like that concept, like it's just it's really easy. Yeah, pick a great source material.
Yeah.
Add tits.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. And but like
the story's all written there for you, and it's beautifully done. Like some of the scenes, yeah, it's amazing, and it's so they didn't skimp out. Like because the movie goes on at such a like crazy clip, I don't think they use the same scene twice.
No,
they're always not. And it's always huge, like castles, beautiful meadows. They're going all over the place. But they still couldn't hire anyone who acted.
Well,
I don't
know where the money was shot. Like a lot of it was shot near his house.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And obviously Irish actors.
Oh, was he living?
He lived in Ireland. He lived up in Wicklow. Yeah.
Yeah, I saw there's a monument down in
Carra Castle.
Yeah, to it. Well, so where we cut?
So Gabriel Byrne shapeshifts, basically.
He shapeshifts into your man.
But then the plan is also because they set it up like it's a ruse that they're trying to trick them out of the castle.
Yeah.
He's like, we'll follow them and finish them off at nightfall. But it turns out that is actually part of the plan.
Yeah.
And he just lets all his men get attacked and ambushed so that he can go in and fuck this woman while pretending to be her husband. And then he also does Merlin magics it so that
awakens the dragon.
Yeah, I don't really know what that was about.
Yeah,
he's able to ride across the mist with his horse for no reason.
What's that theory? Is it like Chekhov's gun or wherever? If you introduce the concept of a gun, it better go off. You better see,
you have to use it. Yeah,
dragon's the same thing. If you're going to be telling me about a dragon,
yeah,
and then he does that whole long spiel about how it's even just like the sight of it, like rip you into shreds. Show me the fucking dragon.
Well, it's the force.
This isn't...
Yes, there you go. Yeah. That's exactly... Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. It's the force. That's basically it. That's what... Like, you know, George Lucas is one of the biggest thieves going because, like, he basically robbed from everything. He robbed from Dune. He robbed from Arthurian legend. He robbed from...
I think he's said, because it was in the research for it, he's an Excalibur fan.
Like,
Totally.
Yeah. And like you can see that like that concept of like the dragon's breath and the dragon is everywhere kind of thing, like that is something that was literally in the Death of Arthur, the source material for this. But that was something that Lucas saw, was like, oh, that could work for the force because that's kind of a religion and you can see it and not feel it and blah blah blah, and that it has a mystical quality but it can never be explained kind of thing. Like,
gotcha.
Until you make three more films and explain it was midichlorians
all along, that it was these tiny little antibodies.
Like, but you can actually see, you can see the sort of Excalibur vibes of like when he sort of Lucas unleashed and he made those first three, like the campy love story between Padme and Darth Vader, whatever his name is, Anakin. Just like falling in love at first sight, you know, there's whole sequences in the second one where they're like rolling around in grassy meadows.
Yeah, totally. And really, that's completely like that's later on in the film, like when Lancelot and Guinevere meet and fall in love and stuff like that. That's very, very similar. Like, that kind of lushness. And like, it does, like the film does this thing really well, I think, where, you know, the scenery kind of dictates what's actually going on in the film and what's going on with Arthur, because like there's that line in the film where Merlin says like, you are the land and the land is you, when the land is flourishing you will flourish, so like when Arthur thinks everything's going well in the in you know England or Great Britain or whatever, and you know everything's like in bloom and all this kind of stuff, and then as soon as he figures out that, you know, Guinevere is off with your one and you know, his pride and his vanity has kind of led him astray, then things start to go terrible. And then you kind of see everything's like dark and murky and it's pissing of rain and it's all this kind of stuff. And then again, to go back to the start, when Uther is doing his shapeshifting and riding your one, it's all in the dark, you know, it's all, things are on fire. That's the idea of like the beginning of the world kind of thing, the beginning of this land, and the idea of like it's born of fire and like the Big Bang almost to
but it, like it is a very, in that sense it's a very high concept film, then the idea of them screaming it ruins it, there's no subtlety, it does
like there's no defending it, like the screaming and the shouting is just ridiculous. Even
the acting, although actually one of the worst actors I thought was, it was before I realized it was his daughter, but she's god awful in that opening bits. But like a lot of he can't really act, Arthur. Even like, you know,
he's not done much since, has he?
Or is he's only ever done a few bits and bobs.
Yeah, there's a few of them when I Google their names, like the Excalibur is the thing that comes up.
Yeah,
because that's all they've done.
Yeah,
And then obviously there's like Patrick Stewart. But even Patrick Stewart's very thespian-y. Liam Neeson is fucking atrocious. Liam Neeson mostly just speaks in grunts when he's in it.
He was busy writing Helen Mirren.
Yeah, that's true.
Did you ever hear that story
about them?
No.
Right, so basically, there's a well-known broadcaster who you know, by the way. I think you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say his name.
I'll tell you afterwards.
But he used to live above Liam Neeson. And Helen Mirren used to come in. This was like in the 80s in Dublin when the two of them were, I think he was in like the Abbey or something like that. Or he was in the Peacock, whatever. He was in one of the theatres. And he used to say that like Helen Mirren used to come in after the show and he'd literally see his like lights swinging and like dust coming out of like the... Oh yeah, no, he said the two of them just milling each other out of it.
You love to hear it.
I heard that. I was like, that's fair play to Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
You know, two of them in their prime.
You know, Liam Neeson, he was a fucking... Yeah, he looks kicked in this film, but he was a handsome man.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, like, well done. Like, and I'm like, fair play to everybody involved. I'm delighted that they're having a great time.
Well, I watched Darkman there over lockdown with... there's another... I'm sure we were in the same time as this. Here's Liam Neeson and...
Frances McDormand,
yeah, two amazing actors, similar to Excalibur, and that's two amazing actors given dog shit
performances.
Well, they're good in it, insofar as the movie is got like terrible.
Yeah,
but they're doing their best with it.
That I think is funny you say that, because when I look at Excalibur, it's like I've always wondered about this. Is it like John Borman was standing behind the camera, roaring at them, shout more, I need more, or was it did they just kind of look around them, see that everything was on fire, or see that, you know, it was this kind of big ridiculousness, I'm dressed like I'm made of tin, you know, all this kind of stuff, and they're in their head are like, okay, time for me to amp it up here.
Let's go full. It reminded me of, did you ever see the clip of American Psycho, like the any of the like the club scenes before they've added in the music afterwards, so you can just see it like that, like Christian Bale be like, hey, but it's just an entire club, it's full of people, but it's all silent.
Oh, okay.
And it's just the straight, that's exactly what it reminded me of.
Like, I wonder, like, it would, like who made the choice there in Excalibur? Was it the actors or was it the director?
This is a very professional now. My cat is...
he's lovely.
Well, she's a bastard. He's looking for food and I don't have any food.
But so we left it at Gabriel Byrne. He's had sex now. She bears him a child.
In full armor. Helen
Mirren is looking on.
Yeah.
Morgana.
Morgana. Yeah. He's looking on. Like, eye contact with the man. And she knows. She can see through... Yeah. Merlin's magic, and she just sees some lad riding her mother.
Well, it was because later you don't see her for a while, and later on she comes back, and she's like the antagonist, and she's a crazy like magic lady.
Yeah,
but for a couple of moments I was like, why is she doing? Oh no, I remember the weird sexual eye contact thing. Yeah,
it's gotten there now. We're up to date now. It's come full circle. Yeah. It's like you were saying this earlier, like this film doesn't hold your hand in any way, shape or form, and it's either figure it out or you're left behind. And I think, you know, that is a thing of you were saying, like, if this was released now, it would probably be a TV series or something like that.
Yeah, you could definitely extend that out.
Yeah, but also as well, I think it would not be as it would be a lot more clearly signposted, and I think it would lose a lot of its... Because, like, it's...
Madness.
Yeah. Because, like, there is something really dreamlike about this film. Like, it is kind of, like, images passing before your eyes, and, like, some of it makes sense, some of it doesn't. Yeah. Whereas, if it was done now, like, you look at something like Game of Thrones, and, like, I would argue Game of Thrones has a similar amount of sex, a similar amount of violence, a similar amount of bad acting as well, almost.
Fair.
You know, like Aidan Gillen, come on now.
Ten accents in one scene.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, like 10 accents in one scene, Aidan Gillen. Like. But because Game of Thrones is so kind of procedural and it's so episodic and it's moving here and it's moving there and they're doing this and they're doing that, whereas in Excalibur, it's like you're kind of almost like, the fuck is going on? Oh, yeah. They're doing this now. Oh, okay, yeah. I get it. I kind of have a loose grip on the plot.
That's I had a very loose grip because I was like, I don't know who the names are of most of these people because they very rarely say them, if ever.
Yeah.
And then Asa, that's tough. Everyone's wearing like chainmail armor.
Yeah. They all look the same.
Everyone looks the same.
Yeah.
I don't know who's doing what for who.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I was still not sure if Merlin's good or evil. I have, concept.
Who's to say?
You.
Probably the film.
Us maybe on the podcast talking about the film.
Yeah, maybe. But, because anyway, so this is where the big first jump is. Oh, yeah, so sorry. Yeah, Merlin's deal where he changes, not Gabriel, but Earl Uther. His deal is that he gets the product of their lovemaking.
Mm.
So he gets the sun. He has a change of heart when he sees the sun. All of a sudden, he decides to put evilness away and he decides to become a good dad.
Well, he forgot about it.
He forgot about it entirely, yeah. And then he saw the boy, and then Merlin shows up and he takes the boy. And then there's some real, real bad acting.
Oh, yeah.
But there's good dialogue in there. And there's bits like that first. So that's probably about 40 minutes, is it? Like that whole bit.
Yeah, sounds about right, yeah.
That would have been a good film as a prequel or the first in like a trilogy of what's happening.
He said the initial cut was 3 hours. So this is 220. So they could have made just two films. They could have easily just an hour and a half each.
Because there's really interesting stories there. Is what is there for me? Nothing but war. And is it not my right to be a happy father as well or whatever? There's interesting stuff there.
It's like, no, go and die.
Yeah, like, no. See, because up until that point, Merlin seems very sinister and he's not very comical.
Yeah.
He's more like, I'm going to help you rape this woman. I'll go to sleep for 9 months and I'll be back for that kid. And then
just you wait, buddy.
Yeah.
And he says that it's like all the work I did for you, he basically says, I was so tired I had to take 9 months off.
Yeah.
I was so drained of energy having helped you rape that lady.
Yeah, yeah.
That I had to just go home and sleep for hibernate for 9 months.
You had to get off Twitter for 9 months before he got, in case he got cancelled, keep the head down. But,
and then reemerge. Like, right, time for the baby. Bye-bye.
Yeah. And so then this is the first jump then, and we jump forward to,
he leaves, takes the kid, and then Gabriel Byrne, eventually his wife goes, or his missus, like, go after him. And he's like, oh yeah, I could do that.
Yeah.
And then just like starts chasing him and screaming, Merlin, Merlin. And then he gets ambushed or falls off a horse and dies.
He just gets to like dies basically horribly and violently kind of thing. Yeah.
But again, that's a great scene where he's being chased. Not slowly, and they're all sort of like trudging up a hill because they're all battle weary, and he gets his sword, which is plastic looking as fuck, and sticks it into the stone. And Merlin does a like double take. I like the bits in this where Merlin is sort of shocked.
Yeah.
Because he's supposed to see all the future now.
So yeah, so Gabriel Byrne then dies, having dropped the stone, the sword into the stone. Yeah.
Doesn't really explain why or how he does that. Doesn't matter.
If I can't have it, no one else can.
Yeah, but then he puts it into the rock magically. He's not
Excalibur's magic.
Yeah, but he's not.
But the sword is.
But the sword is the magic ability to not let anyone use it other than this madman who just raped a woman.
But the sword does fuck all for the whole film.
Yeah.
You think that like it's this otherworldly sword that's gonna like unite nations, you can do everything. You think at one point someone would have it in a fight scene.
Oh yeah.
Like,
well, they have it in a fight scene, but it only it shows it hacking an arm off like a regular sword.
Yeah.
Or on hitting the armor of Lancelot.
Oh, that's right.
Then it breaks.
Yes.
And so he throws it away.
Yeah.
And the Lady of the Lake gives it back to him. That's also Borman's daughter.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
That's his other daughter.
Oh.
So he had three kids in it. That's why there's a...
Now, do you want to get your tits out or do you want to lie in a lake? You got to pick one of them.
You can either have pneumonia or you can show a tit. Yeah. You decide.
Because again, it doesn't explain any of that stuff, which I only know from that Monty Python sketch, like how it was Arthur decreed some watery tart throwing a sword out of the pond. But there's a scene at the start where you see a hand come out of the water and it's holding a sword, and that's where Merlin gets it. Doesn't explain any of that. That's literally... This is what you were talking about, Brian. There's so many scenes that are just like 2 seconds long.
Yeah.
And it cuts to something that's entirely like, was that, is that important? What
was
that?
Was I supposed to follow that?
Yeah.
Was that supposed to be a thing? Yeah, no, like it's, yeah, like there's no, like whatever kind of linear narrative exists in it, it's so fucking tenuous.
Yeah.
It's so tenuous. Like it's just like, you'll see little clips, you'll see little scenes, you'll see little things and you're like, is that important? Is that not important?
Mm.
And like, I like that. I like the fact that I have to think about it when I watch it, like that I have to pay attention, because I mean, you can't, like, it's definitely a film you can't watch passively, because one, it's too loud.
Yeah.
It's too over the top. And also as well, if you miss something in it, you will be lost. But then in saying that, it's not really a film that relies too kind of hard on plot and narrative. Like,
no.
It's kind of, it almost breaks down into like
three acts.
Kind of like vignettes even within them. Because there's the Holy Grail act.
Yeah.
Which all of that feels kind of rushed and forced at the end. It's like, oh, we also...
The whole film is rushed and forced.
Yeah, totally. Like, it doesn't have... Like, you know, we've been saying this repeatedly. Like, you could easily break this film into, like, four or five different films, like Lord of the Rings or something like that. But trying to condense it all down gives it a manic quality. And I think gives it an almost sort of impressionist kind of quality that I was like, it's big strokes, it's big, it's big parts of it, like it's all just kind of smushed together. And if you figure it out, great. If you don't, well, you're seeing something gorgeous, like what of it? Like,
and you kind of get the basic plot. You don't need to understand who the woman in the lake is. It's not important.
No,
And like, just anytime Arthur's around and he's talking, just keep an eye on him.
So it's often hard to tell who he is, and you'd be watching it for a minute and be like, oh right, that's him still. I see that.
When he grew the beard to show in his middle age stage, I was like, they recast him. It's a new guy. I thought they changed his hair color as well. It's like, no, it's very difficult to notice him.
It was genuine only from dialogue that I knew that it was Arthur, because that's when he starts using his different voice.
And his beard.
He says he's the king, but that's not the same guy as, oh, it is, but he's just...
There is something, like, I've never seen such poor casting as him as Arthur. Because I just could, like... I get that the whole thing is that, like, you know, he's meant to be humble and he's meant to be sort of like, he seeks not to lead. He's called to it kind of thing. And that's a big thing in all loads of fantasy films. You know, it's in Dune even.
No, you said Arthur or the actual actor himself. No, he's not seeking to lead. They're just forcing him to do it.
There you go. That's it. Like, I could probably see John Borman's thought process and be like, this guy isn't a leading man at all, but I'll make him one. Here, you're going to be Arthur. And he's like, I can't be Arthur. Mm. Fuck no, you're going to be Arthur. I'm going to make you. You shout enough and you will be Arthur. But in watching it, I'm like, I wouldn't follow him to the shops. I certainly wouldn't follow him into battle. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's so ridiculous. Like,
especially compared to the other one, the other knights.
Lancelot. Yeah.
Lancelot or any of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're all big, burly men's men.
Oh, yeah. They're manly men. Like, they're men in tights.
But if Borman said that he wanted to cast, like, relatively unknown or completely unknowns, it's just weird that in hindsight, so many of them went on to be very famous actors.
Yeah,
because it's all like their first roles. But it's because you're looking at Neeson, Mirren, Gabriel Byrne, Kieran Hines, all those. It's just that the main guy that they needed didn't become a great actor. Like, could you imagine like Liam Neeson as Merlin? As Arthur.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, actually, for Merlin, Sean Connery was signed on, I think, at one point to play him. I have this wrote down somewhere. There was like four or five people, and it ended up being this guy who wasn't going to do it initially because him and Helen Mirren hated each other.
Yes, I'd read that.
Yeah, they did Macbeth together.
Yeah, and it was a shit show. And Boardman was like, this will be good. I'll use that tension. Which seems like one of those cracked ideas that the writers have from time to time.
Yeah.
And also probably because he'd started a film and was like, I'm not fucking hiring someone else.
Oh, yeah, fuck this.
Let's just go with this.
Yeah.
Oh, Donald Sutherland was the one he wanted. Lee Marvin for a little bit, they were thinking.
Ooh.
But Max von Sydow.
Ooh, I could see that, yeah.
Yeah, that would be... He's one of those... I can never even place what films he's in.
But you know him.
Such a distinctive man.
Oh, completely. I think that's a great thing about this one, which is you don't see anymore, is the idea of a director kind of being like, I don't give a shit. I'm picking this guy. This is my guy to do it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, these two people hate each other. Fucking use it.
Yeah.
Because in Game of Thrones, just to keep going back to Game of Thrones, like, there's this whole thing with Lena Headey and your man Jerome Robson.
Yes.
They used to date, and they hate each other now. And they had a clause in their, both of them had a clause in their contract that they would never have to do a scene together and would never be on set together.
Jesus. But so the whole way through, they're never in a scene together. Even yeah. though for a lot of it, what, he's like training her brother.
Yeah.
So they're in and around the same.
They're in the same building the whole time. But they just never crossed paths.
Yeah.
And again, that was because the two of them disliked each other and they had a clause in their contract.
Yeah.
I would bet if something like that had happened in the 70s, directors would probably be like, oh yeah, fuck it. Yeah, yeah, totally getting the scene. Use that hate.
Yeah.
Use that years of bitterness, like kind of thing. And, you know, is that good or is that bad? I don't know. It's probably bad. But
probably
like,
is. I think any actors I've ever talked to, it really falls down to like personal preference.
Yeah.
Like some people want every last bit of like drop of emotion, like wrangled out with them. Yeah. And some people want like a safe space where they're allowed to do like feel comfortable.
Yeah. But also in those situations, like, well, this is the job. If you don't like it, you just get a different role in the film with like, you know, well, like in that case, you're like, right, you know, you have differences or whatever. If it's important for the plot for those two characters to talk to each other, fucking get over it.
Yeah, and just get on with it. Job. Yeah.
Or, yeah, just get a different acting role.
You're acting for a living. You could act like you don't hate the person for like
1 hour. For 5 minutes. Exactly. Yeah, for 1 hour. Like,
in theory, you're supposed to be disappearing into your character anyway. It's not you talking to this guy. Yeah. It's you fucking. Yeah.
You don't need to use any of your own personal shit. Use it if it helps, but you don't need it.
Yeah.
And I mean, kind of see that as well, like in the way that like, Merlin and Morgana kind of act with each other, like, because they're very like, it's one of the few scenes in it, I think, in the later part of the film where Merlin is a lot more serious, like, and he's very much almost going back to where he was at the beginning of the film, like, where he is, you think he's almost evil, like, and you think that he's like, he's going to kill her, and then she is very, Morgana is very kind of austere and won't speak to him and doesn't even look at him or whatever, but then she desperately wants, and you know, I think the fact that she eventually gets the drop on him, and I'm jumping way ahead now, but when she gets the drop on him and then freezes him in that like Fortress of Solitude place, that their dynamic, their off-screen dynamic had an impact on it in that kind of way. It felt a bit more kind of authentic, as much as this film can be authentic, you know, which is not a lot and not very often.
No.
Well, I mean, it's probably it's authentic to the source material.
At
least it has that.
It has that going for it, but the performance is everything else. Yeah. Completely. Although, not that.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Considering how over the top most things are in the film, the scene of him pulling the sword out of the stone is just very underplayed.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And also, I would think that if that happens and a guy shoves the sword in there, I want to see a scene of 100 lads in a queue all trying to have a go.
Yeah.
Like we see like one guy have a pull off it. I'm like, if that was at, like where I'm from, that would be, you know, every day.
Everyone would be down lads after the pub, straight down to the sword.
You'd have a trip set up for it. You'd be like, it'll be bringing tourism.
So that's as far as we got in the description of it. Yeah. So that's the next scene. And that's a good jump cut. They do sort of, you can tell from context what's happened there. There's like a town is now set up around, not even a town, just like a little settlement set up around the sword. And they've got like a priest there looking after it. And there's a tournament and young Arthur shows up with Kay and the dad to joust at a tournament, and he loses Kay's sword, and he goes and to find another sword. He pulls the thing out of the stone, and there he is. But do you remember that film from the 60s? I don't know. Was it Disney one, The Sword in the Stone?
Yeah,
yeah. That's where I mostly know this story from.
Yeah, I think that's where most people know it from.
Yeah, do you reckon? That was a good film. Much better than Excalibur, I think. But Kay is much meaner to them, to young Arthur, in that they focus more on his early life and how much she was kicked around.
Yeah. Because
in this film, they seem very civil, very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they treat him like... he's a squire, but he seems happy out.
Yeah.
But then he stops becoming a squire in a great scene. Like one of those, what you were saying earlier about when Merlin doesn't know, like... those moments where he can't see the future, he doesn't know what's going to happen, and he just walks out and sees him like in a river on his knees, having given Excalibur to his like enemy, so he can knight him, so then he can like show him mercy. Like, that would have been so fun to just see his.
His whole thing is he's supposed to be, you know, honorable and he's pure,
humble.
That's just thick.
This is
right after that scene. Basically, he pulls the sword out. Everyone around him immediately fractures. I'm not following this boy. The boy king will lead us. And then him and Merlin like piss off in the woods for a minute. And he explains that the dragon is the Force. And he's like, Excalibur is part of the Force. And Merlin's like, you've got it now. He's like, fuck, he has no idea what the fuck he's talking about. He's just
like,
saying
it's like
yes.
His Yoda moment. Learn like everything about it. I can see a lot of the similarities between those films.
Totally. And like again, you're talking about shouting acting. There is so much shouting acting in the scene when it all fractures and like decides to follow him, because like Patrick Stewart is in there hamming it Kieran Hines
screaming at
the
Merlin.
Top of his lungs.
Merlin, I'm like, the devil is back.
You've tricked us, you devil.
But like Patrick Stewart, like I almost feel like him and Kieran Hines were like, right, we've got like 5 minutes to make an impact here.
Yeah.
We are fucking going balls out here, lads. Let's go warp engine 5. Let's just blast the shit out of this.
Or what if it's like on set, because people probably weren't there for the entirety, entirety of it. Maybe they came in a few weeks for just 1 or 2 weeks here and there. But Merlin's probably on for the whole set.
Yeah.
Same as like your man who's playing Arthur.
Yeah.
Maybe other guys just got to the set and were like, oh, this is what we're doing?
Yeah,
okay,
cool.
Because everyone's doing this? Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Or maybe, Patrick Stewart's stuff was day one and he
set the tone,
and they're like, oh, well, he's a real actor from he's done in the Globe doing Shakespeare, so this must be what acting is. And then they all just went nuts with it.
Yeah, because I'd say he was like, I mean, he was probably like fairly well, he would have been like, he definitely hadn't done Star Trek by that stage, but like he was definitely well established, like he had done like I, Claudius, like, which was this like really famous BBC series that was done out of like Julius Caesar and stuff like that, and it was huge.
Yeah.
And he was really a known quantity in acting circles. So like if he came up and it was like he's screaming at the top of his lungs, okay, fuck it, everyone do it. Yeah, you're totally right. That's where they're like, oh well, shit, Patrick Stewart's doing it. We gotta do it now. Like,
he's the real deal.
Mm.
But
not enough of him, considering that he is like would have been one of the more well known people at the time to be cast. Yeah. It's in such a minimal role.
Yeah.
And there's really, I don't even think there's any close ups of him or
no.
There's some shots, maybe it was just the dodgy link that I watched it on. But it was like the framing was cutting off parts of his forehead.
Like there are a lot of scenes like that where it's like some people are out of focus.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
I have a feeling that they shot it all on one lens.
Yeah.
Like a 50mm or something, just because it all looks quite similar and there's like very few wide shots.
Yeah.
Even in like the giant battle scenes, they're just like, no, we're going to stay very tight. Even that intro battle scene.
Yes.
It's all very condensed.
There's a beautiful wide shot when Arthur's jousting against Lancelot the first time. There's a beautiful shot of the two horses coming at each other.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It doesn't really...
Oh, I also meant to say earlier in that first battle scene, they had to film that 3 times because they were using like old school film reel at the time. So like the ISO value, they fucked it up because it's a nighttime shoot.
Yeah, yeah.
So they did it twice and it was still like they couldn't recover the footage. So they were like, third time's a charm. Apart from the cameraman or cinematographer freaked out and like quit.
Jesus.
They must have had a few of them, I guess.
But one
of them was just like, I'm not doing it a third fucking time.
No, I can't light more shit on fire. I can't have more horses here. Yeah. You fucking figure this out. Like, yeah.
So that's the... Are we at the end of the second act there, then?
He becomes king. Yeah, he goes to Patrick Stewart's castle. He gets himself knighted by giving his sword to his enemy. And for some reason, the guy
is impressed with it.
Yeah. Yeah. But then you're kind of whatever about this, because this is supposed to be your king. He's supposed to lead you. What if he does this to the next enemy and they kill him? You're like, he's a man's an idiot. But they knight him, he becomes king, and then they go about... Yeah, what is the next part? They just
He falls in, that's when he meets his missus?
Yeah, that's when he meets Guinevere and then falls in love, and it's all very kind of chaste, and it's all... Like, I would actually say like the relationship that Arthur and Guinevere have is like probably one of like... I know it's meant to be pure and it's meant to be chaste and it's meant to be all sort of romantic, but it's like the most bloodless and the most kind of tepid.
Yeah.
Out of all of it, you know what I mean?
There's no Cornwall dancing.
No.
Riding with your armor on.
None the, of
yeah,
that.
It's very yeah.
Well, she brought him like cakes. There was that.
That's what I mean. Yeah, like, that's what I mean. Like, it was so kind of like, it was so PG-13, and the rest of the film is like 18.
Yeah.
Because Merlin uses the like the cakes as an analogy.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
her vagina, basically.
Yes. And it's very like, you know, the just eat the damn apple.
Yeah.
Or is it the orange? What is it in The Simpsons?
Oh, yeah, the orange.
It is.
Yeah.
It is
the secret
orange.
Of a good marriage. The secret of a good marriage is a lot like an orange.
If I wanted to know how to eat an orange, it'd be at the orange eating class.
just eat the damn orange.
Oh, we did so well. We got like over an hour in before we did The Simpsons.
It was always going to happen.
Yeah, it's always going to happen.
But there is a funny line. There's bits of this film that are like genuinely good. But there's a funny line where he's asking. Also, yeah, Arthur asks Merlin what the future of Guinevere is going to be. A lot of the times he asks Merlin stuff, he's like, and don't give me one of your riddles, give me a straight answer. By and large, he gives him straight answers every time.
Yeah, true.
But he's always saying like, he'll always answer either yes or no or give him an honest answer. And he's like, not a riddle as usual. He's like, he fucking never gives you riddles. You're just thick. He asks him what's going to happen with Guinevere. And Arthur says, or Merlin says something like, you will fall in love and you will be betrayed by your best friend. And then Arthur goes, we'll fall in love. He's like, you fucking idiot. And like, that's good. And that's when you see like comedic Merlin starting to come in. But, yeah, so he is just giving him advice. He's just not paying attention to him. Yeah. They fall in love. They get married then. Is this the next scene? And Morgana shows up again at that point.
Yeah, she shows up at the wedding, yeah.
Yeah, and Merlin says, listen, baby, it's a man's world, basically.
Yeah. Really kind of like, and again, that's one thing I would say that I liked about this film was that like, it does kind of, and like here we are, like we're three men here, like, and we're talking about this, but like it really does kind of play up the fact that like women were basically sidelined as much as possible in, you know, medieval tales, like, you know, that kind of way. And anytime that they did ever kind of assert themselves, they asserted themselves in an antagonistic fashion, you know, that kind of way. Like, as in, like, John Borman, I think, was smart enough to recognize that, like, you know, like, Morgana was kind of in the right, almost.
Yeah, like, her life story is basically, I had a mom and dad, and then this guy killed my dad, basically, and then he fucked my mother in front of me.
Yeah, and then my half-brother then went on to become king. It should have been me.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to fuck him up. Like, I mean, you can kind of, like, you watch it, you could easily watch this film and be like, actually, no, she was in the right the whole time.
Yeah.
And it does, because, like, the film is so wishy-washy with, you know, you don't know if Merlin is on everybody's side. You don't know who's on whose side. You could very easily watch this film and get that reading from it quite easily. Like, which, again, is something that I like about this film that other people don't, is that it's ambiguous. Like, it's quite an ambiguous film from that regard.
But he finds, next up then, he meets Lancelot, a knight who's given up his kingdom.
Yes.
Given up all of everything he has to go and just fight for the king. He wants to be bested by someone, so then he'll be like his servant.
Yeah.
Like, I've never met a man who can beat me. And then he's like, well, what if I use a magic sword? You're like, okay.
Yeah. Hit it, buddy.
Yeah. And this is a jump forward where, this is whatever, 10 years later, and Arthur is now
pretty well established.
He's pretty well established now. Nowhere has rage issues.
Mm.
Like, you never really see. He's very meek and humble, and then it just jumps forward to he's being king for a while, I guess.
Absolute power, man.
Yeah, he's really thick, and then he kills Lancelot, and then he's very sad about that. He's like, shouldn't have killed such a handsome man.
Mm.
And doesn't kill him, does he?
He sort of hinted at that, like, he injures him, but he injured him out of pride, almost. Like, his pride is, you know, he used the sword for evil, basically. Oh, used it because he wanted to defeat this man.
Yeah.
Because they show him later on, because he's kind of like a scruffy, homeless-looking kind of state.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah. I love that bit.
That's great. Because and he comes back and fights in the last battle.
Yeah.
Like that as well. Yeah. You can hear him all screaming, Lancelot. I'm like, this is... You cannot tell it's him.
Yeah. Oh, no, at all.
It's a different character. He's like probably 40 years older than that actor. And it's like, you could have just got... everyone else has played multiple generations.
Yeah. Like, I love that bit when he turns up later. And he's like, yeah, he's like got white hair and he looks ancient and he looks terrifying. He's like screaming at, was it Gawain, was it? Or was it? He was screaming at one of the knights or something like that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Yeah. Oh, it's the Percival.
Yeah. Percival. He's screaming at Percival and he's all like, you know, like it's brilliant. Like it's so good. And again, it's that thing of, you know, the idea of generational kind of like that it's, you know, from young to middle to old, and that Lancelot, even in this world, this kind of like almost apocalyptic kind of version of how things went, everything went so bad that even Lancelot, who was this, you know, beautiful knight, is now this ancient man screaming nuttily at Percival, who is been inspired by Lancelot, has been inspired by all these other knights, and is trying to kind of find his way in it. Yeah, I love that bit. I love that twist.
Yeah.
Well, it is kind of cool as well to see like the giant time jumps and how characters change so much
in an instant. Yeah,
which is like, it makes sense because it's an instant for us, but it's like 20, 30 years. Yeah, often. Oh, no,
it's definitely cool, and it speaks to the scope of the film. It would have just been handy if, again,
there was any sort of indication
that this is happening.
Yeah,
said people's names.
Yeah,
put some writing on the screen.
Yeah.
George Lucas kind of fixed the issue by just doing a preamble of text right before.
Yes.
It's just going to be like, here's 1 minute, just going to let you know exactly what's happening, and then we'll start because it's a bit mad.
Yeah.
And even when they do have like the pretext, the preamble in Excalibur, like it's literally just in the Dark Ages, land was without a king, and it's just literally...
Oh, I have it wrote down because it pissed me off so much.
Oh, really?
I thought it was going to be like a poem that rhymed.
Sure.
And then it didn't rhyme. So it says, the Dark Ages, the land was divided and without a king. Out of those lost centuries rose a legend of the sorcerer, Merlin, of the coming of a king, of the sword of power, Excalibur. It's like, surely you could get something in there that would rhyme.
Power Excalibur.
Yeah, but it's like such a hard cut because that's when it comes up on screen. Like,
but
the
that's
text
so
Excalibur.
Cool,
and it is really cool, but it's just the audio of them, the last word being power and then Excalibur.
Well, so then that scene, you said it earlier, but that's the scene where he's fighting Lancelot, is the first time you see someone use Excalibur as a weapon other than the sword, even though it is still just a sword. He calls on the power of Excalibur, and it fucking breaks.
Yeah,
and he doesn't even kill. Nothing happens. It's useless. And then the Lady of the Lake shows up again, and gives it back to him, and he's learned his lesson.
Mm-hmm. And Lancelot, so he loses because he gets hit by the sword. It breaks, and he throws it away. I'd be thinking, all right, now I can take him.
Yeah. Now
like,
I got him. Now
he's just broken
now
the magic
it's a good
sword.
Fight. Yeah. Now I got him.
And so then Lancelot swears fealty to him and stops blocking the bridge, which for some reason had brought England to a standstill.
Apparently, yeah.
And then he falls in love with, how do I pronounce her name?
Guinevere.
Guinevere.
Yes, immediately.
Yeah. Immediately, which is fair. She makes pastries and cakes.
Yep.
She doesn't dance as much. Or does she? She dances actually very nicely, I think.
Yes. She's very, very chaste.
Mm. Yeah, very chaste, not the dirty...
No, traditional Cornus Moroccan dance from the start.
Well, she wasn't related to Bourbon, so he was like, just do,
You do whatever there. Yeah, that's fine.
And I mean, this isn't like all movies have this, but they don't even attempt to explain why either Arthur or Lancelot loves Guinevere. They do it a bit more with Arthur, but like, there's no scenes with Lancelot and Guinevere talking or really even interacting at all.
There's one when they're both on horses, and like, is there a special lady in your life? And he's like, oh, there is.
Shift my mate.
It's you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and she's like, oh, don't be like that. It's like, you're the queen. He's gonna. If anyone has heard this, he's getting his head chopped off.
Yeah.
But no, say that's a nice little love story. Because there's nothing with Arthur and her, like we'd said, that there's no real passion
it's
there.
It's real sex. Yeah.
So it's kind of like, give her something. There's like, this guy is definitely more handsome.
Yeah.
He seems like a leader. Cool guy.
Yeah.
So happy for her.
Yeah. He's a bit cracked in that his whole thing is that he just wants to serve.
Yeah, that's the thing of it, isn't it? Like, it's that thing of he should have been king. Like he, as you said, like he's definitely more of a leader, definitely more handsome, definitely seems to be more sure of himself than Arthur does. But then I suppose it's that thing of like, again, it goes back to the whole thing of like, if you wield Excalibur, if you have Excalibur, it's, you know, you can't seek it. It has to be given to you.
Yeah.
You have to be chosen to it.
Mm-hmm.
That thing. And that, like, it's like, I mean, this is even to get really up in it for a minute, but like, it is the thing of like the people who generally seek power are the last people who should have it.
Yeah.
And like, not that Lancelot is that, but he seems the most suited towards it.
And he's already given up his kingdom and his like,
yeah,
basically power, because you're like having a fixed address.
Yeah,
he had to have troops and around. He's not just on his own running around like trying to kill people.
Yeah.
But like, so he is kind of altruistic in that sense. So
yeah.
He's like, he is the noble knight
who just lives in the woods like a bum.
Yeah. But like, Aragorn's like that.
Yeah.
That's true.
In a sense.
And again, yeah. Like, and again, yeah. And even as well, I always thought as well, the fact that the sword cracked reminded me of Lord of the Rings. Yeah. When the, what do you call it? Isildur's thing breaks when he cuts off Sauron's hand. Like,
yeah.
You know, but obviously that's different. Like, that was done because it was like, that was done for good, whereas when that happens in Excalibur, it's done for the wrong reasons, you know?
But they get the new sword back. Lancelot ends up riding Guinevere? What am I
saying? Guinevere.
I'm just going to get it wrong every time, a new name of each type. But so they go off, have a little bit of sex.
Mm.
They wake up. Oh, Jesus, there's a fucking sword in the ground. Whose sword is it? Arthur knows.
Well, before that, there's a lot of stuff where Morgana sort of puts it in his ear, and Liam Neeson's character, looking like a sweaty ham, brings it up. They're all sitting around like, isn't everything great? We've vanquished evil.
Here we are now, all the lads.
All the lads, this is class. Have we beaten evil Merlin? And Merlin says, no, don't be thick. And then Liam Neeson says, Lancelot's sleeping with your wife. This is before I think they do anything. They're just having looks.
Yeah, there's a lot of like longing looks or whatever. Yeah, and that's because Morgana has been like Yoko Ono on it, basically. Like,
And so he makes a fool of himself.
Has to joust.
This is one of the few flaws I've seen in the film, if you believe it. Because Lancelot, well, we missed out on the Percival character, but I don't really know what the point of him is.
Yeah,
he sort of runs around quickly and he catches a rabbit in another very. But they're just constantly fucking throwing stuff at this film. But when he is traveling back to Camelot, Percival's like, I'll run. And Lancelot says, it's 20 days right away. And yet, when he's challenged to a joust, it's in 2 days' time. Are we to believe he can get there?
Is he that fast of a runner?
Is he that fast?
It is a world of magic.
Yeah.
But like, I mean,
a wizard did it.
This is one of the
few times you're allowed to say that. And it makes sense.
I thought that was a good line actually from Percival in that one, where he's like, it's 20 days right away. He's like, the world isn't that large. Which is, it's a good dialogue, but he's a fucking another terrible actor.
Oh my god, he's an Irish actor, that guy. I could be wrong. I think he's like, he does voice acting for some. Is it like, it's not Mr. Brennan?
Oh,
but it's something like that.
Because I looked him up because I thought he was someone else.
Is he Bosco Hogan? Is that who it is?
No, it's good because he was another one of those actors. I googled their name and like the only thing that came up was Excalibur. Straight away from videos, because I thought he was. I have a guy in my head that he was in Submarine, the dad in Submarine, and he plays one of the scumbags in Game of Thrones as well, actually.
Right.
But I thought it was him anyway. He looked similar.
Okay, right.
But now maybe it was a voice.
I think, because his voice is so distinctive. I'm almost certain he was in something like. Oh, God. I think he was in Braveheart, and I think he was in, like. The Tudors, something like that.
Just when you're talking about distinctive voices, I'd forgotten about Arthur's original voice before he gets shouting. He's so raw. What did you do with my father? Who's my father? Where's my father?
Yeah, so he does an Irish accent, but that's an English actor.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then he changes.
He's so
completely.
Irish.
It's so ridiculous, and it's like it's not even good Irish. No. It's really like I would do everything I could, father.
Mm-hmm. I have the sword. I don't want the sword. I suppose I'll have the sword.
But it's, you know, usually when you hear people say, like, oh, don't worry about accents. You're not going to, like, you know, Valkyrie with Tom Cruise.
Sure.
And you're like, I don't really mind it. Yeah, it's right. I know it's like you're meant to have a German accent or whatever, but because you're speaking in English and the whole film's going to be like that, it's going to be fine. I was thinking about that with this, and it doesn't hold true.
No.
No.
Like, it's just, it's all over the place.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you should, everyone should just have an English accent.
Yes.
Yeah. It worked for Chernobyl.
Patrick Stewart's meant to be French.
Yeah.
Like, he has the most thespian, like, yes. classic English, like, yeah, board yeah. threading. Ha-ha!
Yeah.
It should have been today.
Yeah, like, as in, it's just, like, there's so many decisions made in this film that don't make sense. Mm. But then, when they're all kind of together, they kind of make sense in...
Yeah, there's a cohesion yeah. amongst the craziness. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's probably just, like, in the same way that, like, I don't know, when you're cooking or something and you're just fucking everything into the pot.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, it's stew now. Yeah, so yeah. here it is. And it's all in there. And you're like, okay, this all makes sense, I guess. Yeah. Like, you know, the terrible acting and the terrible voices. And then, you know, the incredible visuals and the cinematography and the music.
Oh, yes. What's the name of that song that I don't know how to do?
Is it O Fortuna?
Yeah,
is it a bit when they're riding off to fight?
I think they use it like two or three times in the film.
Yeah, well, the one that when they're riding off to fight at the very, very end, that's O Fortuna.
That one, O Fortuna, I believe then, because it's that famous one that you have now seen in so many films and TV shows. But I imagine at the time it must have been pretty new.
Oh, that
it might have been the first time that was used in that sense.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like was used in the UEFA Cup or the one of the football tournaments? I'm pretty sure. Oh,
that sounds like where I know it from.
Yeah, no, I've heard it in other stuff. I've heard it like Ozzy Osbourne used to play it before his live shows the 80s. He used to play O Fortuna, and then I think it was like in the UEFA Cup or might have been the World Cup. One of the football tournaments anyway, they had O Fortuna as their thing. But
because it's very impactful. It's
very impactful. Yeah. And like even
the sound design's fantastic actually. Like it's
so good.
Yeah.
So good. But like it's all like that thing at the start is their Gotthard, let's see if I can get this right now. Their Gotthard Dammerung, which is like Wagner, and it's like the Ride of the Valkyries was in this like operatic kind of opera, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like Sigmund's funeral or something like that was like the opening music. Like the main theme from Excalibur was this, but it was written like 150 years ago by Wagner.
Okay.
And he was writing about, again, like German fantasy or whatever. But yeah, no, it's really, really impactful. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As we're on to the last act then.
Pretty much. They joust. Lancelot, and there's a dream sequence where Lancelot fights himself, except he's in the nude and he's fighting an empty suit of armor.
Yeah.
And then...
Oh, and when he fights Liam Neeson at the end when he's about to kill him, and Neeson just goes, the queen is innocent.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
But then he wants to kill him anyway.
So I want that in life. And I want to be able to talk mad shit.
Yeah.
And then when you can't back it up, just go, hold on, I take it back.
Yep, you're dead right. Which, again, is not a fault of the film because this is the original source material, but just the notion of like whoever wins, that's who was right because God ordained it.
Like The Last Duel. Actually, yeah. The Last Duel is very similar to that as well. The idea of like, you know, whoever survives this, that's the way, God intended it to happen. Like,
I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but the Game of Thrones, that's also the same thing. Yeah,
yeah, there was a trial by combat, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that was just a concept of the medieval times, whoever would win it.
But it's such a handy plot device, though, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Like, it's so, like, fuck it, we're going to figure this out by fighting.
Yeah.
Why not? Like,
yeah. So they do that, and then Lancelot falls ill. And Percival, it gets knighted in there as well.
Yeah. Come on, Percy.
Yeah. He's I don't know. I don't know what the crack with his character is, really.
He's so a nothing character, but then is witness to it all.
Yeah.
And then it's that thing of like, I mean, like the Green Knight did it way better, the one with Dev Patel, because that's the same character as Sir Percival.
Yeah.
And what they do in that is that he really highlights the fact that, like, I have no deeds of my own. I have no honor of my own.
Mm.
I have to go off and find something. And then he fights the Green Knight, and then it's all another thing.
Yeah.
But in Excalibur, that character has nothing to do except go out and fetch stuff for people. Like,
yeah.
It's like, go out and find the Holy Grail. King Arthur's not looking great.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, go out and get him some flat seven
up
there. That's
a pretty big task, though.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You that's a bit go like find the thing everyone's been looking for forever.
Yeah, you know, like Liam Neeson, all he had to do was just hang out with Helen Mirren and then accuse somebody and then have a fight, and he got grand.
Mm-hmm.
All the other lads were just like, out having big fights or whatever. He's like, on your own, you've got to go find the Holy Grail.
I'd say they probably just sent them off to be like, you fucking tip on there, find the Holy Grail. Just leave the men at work. And they didn't actually expect them to come back with it.
Yeah, and then when he does rock up with it, it's like, he's all like beaten to shit and he's all like,
Was even on the way in to find the, was it, that's, he's in the creepy woods.
Mm.
There's Borman's son.
Yeah,
where dressed in a gold, he's looked like a kind of like a Cupid type.
Yeah,
but he's a bit like C-3PO. But he leads him in, meets Morgana.
Yeah,
yeah. So that's then. I don't really understand what happens there. Then does she give him the grail? Like, does what? Yeah, I don't really know. Explain this to me.
I don't know either. Okay. I'm gonna be honest. I don't really know either. Like, I think what happens is that like she tries to entice him to be his slave. And that she promises him power and promises him all the things that he wants, like to be a great knight and to be all this, that, and the other. But you just have to give up your soul, and then give up your purity almost.
Yeah, okay.
And then he refuses and then runs off.
Mm.
And then I think after that, then he finds the Grail, I think. Isn't that it?
Yeah.
The Grail thing was very weird.
Very, very weird.
Yeah, it's almost like a dream sequence.
It is like a dream sequence, yeah.
But it seemingly did happen.
Yeah.
So I don't really get it. I don't know who's talking. Like, Arthur's there at one point. He's was Percy talking to him? Is that actually a dream?
Yeah.
When he's like on top of the, like a bunch of steps. There's, I don't know, there's a cat distracting all of us here.
Yeah, I'm just petting him here.
No. I thought that was real. It's a couple of bits that might have been dream sequences or might have been real. But I don't think it really matters because the entire film flows like it's a fever dream.
Exactly. Yeah. And there's that great line towards the end when Merlin and Arthur have their kind of like final meeting, and he goes like, are you real, like Arthur is like basically dying, and he says to Merlin, he says, are you real? And he goes, I am a dream to some, a nightmare to others. That's like one of the best lines in the film.
It's
such a fucking good line. Like,
that's a good line,
but that sums it
all
up.
How is it delivered?
That's it.
I am a dream to some and a nightmare to others. And then Arthur laughs and slaps his knees.
But you know how they do it in the film? Again, this is the thing of like a great line totally fucked.
Yeah.
It's like he goes, a dream to some, a nightmare to others, and then he puts his hands up.
Yeah.
And then it's just like the most
like it's going to be a Rocky freeze frame at the top.
But like, no. It's just he puts his hand up, and then it's just like the most obvious cut in the thing, and he just like disappears. There's no like shimmer, there's no nothing. He's just there 1 second and then gone the next, and you can clearly see the actor who plays Arthur. His head is in one place, and then boom, jumps, and then he's moving. It's like, it's so, like, fucking hell, everyone can see that.
Yeah.
You kind of, there are times you're watching this, and you're like, let them away with a lot of stuff. It was filmed in, like, what was it, 81 or 78?
Yeah, 79, 80.
It's not the fucking 40s. Like, they should have known how to remove a man from a scene without...
Without having
the balls of it.
Yeah, but without completely fucking it up. Yeah.
Or just the forethought of like, okay, how is he going to disappear? Like, you'd think you would like write something in about how we're going to do this instead of just get to it and go, oh, fuck, we didn't write that out. Hard cut?
Yeah.
Hard cut? Anyone for a hard cut?
Sure, why not? Yeah. In the middle of the scene.
Oh, the punters won't notice.
Yeah.
Well, I notice.
But yeah, but that's what,
And it's so, like, but even at that, it's so noticeable. Like, it's so noticeable.
I'm bad for a lot of that stuff, though. Even, like, watching the movies that made us, that Netflix show.
Yeah.
That's when, like, that, like, glass shattering moment of Die Hard. And you're like, oh, yeah, the van that they all arrived in.
Yeah.
There was no, like, a truck in the back of, that. There's no van in the back of the truck. They all just, you know, 13 guys all walk out of the then empty truck.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, how do we get out? Oh, there's a fucking... They said that they just put that in there. They wrote themselves into a corner, just said, fuck it, no one's going to notice, and no one noticed until Netflix made a documentary about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, even the other bit with the... How did John McClane know that that Bill Clay wasn't real, and he gave him an empty gun?
Oh yeah,
and there was a whole scene. There was a whole scene in the film that was cut out of it, that like he recognized a watch that he was wearing, that they all had the same type of watch, and that was just cut out of the film. Like,
I always totally assumed you just didn't trust.
Just didn't trust me. I did too. Yeah, for years I didn't trust.
I thought a wizard did it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's supposed to be a joke. I'm sure it is, but there's, you know, where the smooth talking guy tries to start negotiating with the terrorists.
Ellis.
And then he I think the scene is that one of them comes back and like hands him a can of coke.
Yeah, he asks for coke and then he comes back with a can of coke.
And he's kind of looking at it like, come on, man. You know.
you know what I want.
But that's a good film. We should have watched that.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've probably covered all of the plot then, not sequentially. It was probably the whole thing.
Yeah, they get the Holy Grail at the end.
Now, would you recommend the film to watch it? This is a big question.
This is the thing, right? Would I recommend it? Okay, I think you have to be in the right mindset for it.
Yeah.
I think you've got to be in a very forgiving mood.
Yes.
I think I can, like, you know, when you guys were saying, oh, I fucking hate this one, I'm like, yeah, I can see that. I totally get that. And that's not a reflection. It's not because if you love it, you're better or whatever. It's nothing like that at all. I have a real soft spot for a few reasons. Number one, I love the music.
Yeah.
Number two, the posters for it. Any of the artwork that was made for that film I fucking love it. It's real, like, 80s heavy metal album covers. Yeah.
Yes, kind of stuff. Yes, it's very, like, fantasy. Like
fantasy, meatloaf looking. Just the artwork for it, I love it.
Yeah.
I love the fact that it, like I was saying earlier, that, like, it was made in a time in Ireland when the stuff that it was doing was so counter to everything around it.
Yeah,
I love that aspect of it. Yeah, the culture of it, yeah. And I love the fact that, like, it's so, for all, like, the shouting and all the craziness of it, I think it's a very earnest film. It's very sincere.
Yeah.
And that sincerity, I think, is really interesting. But it's not a good film. I mean, I can't defend it that far. Like, yeah. I can say why I like it, but I can't defend it. Like, it's not a good film. Like,
I think the trouble is, just in this crazy workaday world of ours, you just don't have enough time. And this film is 2.5 hours long, but it feels like about 5.
Oh yeah, it's an epic.
It's interesting to watch, and it is fascinating. And there's bits where we're like, yeah, this, if you did this right, this would be cool.
This would be fantastic.
And the scope of it and the ambition, it's all very admirable. But Jesus.
It's a mess. No, it's a mess.
Yeah.
It's a mess of
But
a
it's
film.
Really the acting that lets it down. If you calmed everyone's fucking beans down and you split it into two films.
Yeah, you'd probably have something a bit more workable.
It would have been.
But it'd probably then just be a generic, like, retelling of the, of, like, the source material.
But so, how many of those are there? I feel like people try and do the Arthurian stuff every once in a while. It's never really. The Green Knight was. I haven't seen it, but I've heard it was.
And Guy Ritchie, like, did
not
Arthur
too well
there.
Received. Yeah, yeah, that bad luck, god awful. Yeah. Arthur came out with, like, a big fucking fur Tom Hardy jacket. I was like, oi. All right, boys. But.
And even, like, going back to, like, that one with Clive Owen, which was also filmed here.
Oh yeah.
Keira Knightley and all that. Yeah. Like, that was. That was very, very generic.
Yeah.
Like, really, really generic. And
Sword in the Stone. That was the one.
Yeah, I mean, like, in fairness, I do think that was the one that, like, probably did it the best and certainly was the most effective, you know? Yeah. But
I think I can't remember what his name is. Was it T.H. Wells? I don't know. The guy who wrote the Sword in the Stone book.
Yeah.
I read it years ago, and there's a really interesting thing in it where Merlin's memory runs backwards.
Yeah.
It's kind of a hard concept to explain because it doesn't really make any sense if you think about it for 2 seconds. Yeah. But basically, how he experiences time is backwards to everyone else in the story. Mm. So when he first meets Arthur, in his mind, that's the last time that they meet.
Yeah.
And then at the end of their relationship years later, it's like.
So it's Tenet.
It's Tenet. Yeah, it's Tenet. Yeah. So he's Teneting the other way. And it's just a really interesting. It makes for very bittersweet moments because then, you know, the first time that they met
is actually
the last time. And, like, he didn't appreciate what it was. Yeah. It's sort of like then dementia on the other side where, like, Merlin's forgetting the whole life that they spent together because for him, he's just experienced there. But I always just remember that as a very interesting
Tenet
concept.
They kind of do that a little bit in Excalibur as well, a certain
amount. I was trying to look out for,
because, like, it's obviously not as explicit as that, but there is that thing of, like, you know, that time is very much a sort of it's almost secondary.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of way. That, like, you were saying it, that, like, you know, if they just put in something to say 5 years later or 10 years later, this film would make a hell of a lot more sense. But, like, because the film is done, as you again described it, as like a fever dream, time doesn't move in the same sort of way, you know. Yeah. Now maybe that's just me being really forgiving.
Yeah, yeah.
And like reading into something that wasn't there, but being trying to explain it. But that's the way I always took it. That like it's time is such a, it's so kind of elastic. It's so kind of not structured in this film that for it to jump 5-10 years and for it to not make any reference to it, like that kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But
Well,
it's kind of proof of like. Nicholas Winding Refn's idea of like just make something look really pretty,
yeah,
and then people will infer their own ideas.
Totally.
Like only God forgives.
Yeah, that's awful. Yeah, it's why like
that's dog shit.
Yeah, but he killed it so hard with Drive, so that you have to just you have to then look into every single thing he's ever done and go, is there? No, there's not.
Like Only God Forgives is a really good example of a film that looks fantastic, but is. Just like I've heard so many readings of Only God Forgives that like, oh no, it's all about sexuality and mothers.
Mm.
And that like at the end he fucks his mother and all this kind of stuff because he puts his hand through her and all this kind of stuff. And like there's a whole thing of like the police officer in it is this evil spirit that's actually in all of his films.
The karaoke guy,
yeah. And that he's like, you know, that the spirit that inhabits him was in Drive and it was in Pusher and it was in what was that one he did with Mads Mikkelsen where he was,
I was gonna say it's not Valhalla, that would have been a weird one.
It was Valhalla.
Was the Japanese guys in Valhalla?
No.
I was gonna say, because that would be the one that you're like, it's in Denmark, it's only Vikings, and there's like just one Asian guy. They're like, okay, maybe he is doing this on purpose.
Valhalla Rising, that's
yes,
like, but that the character that Mads Mikkelsen plays is actually, his spirit is in the guy in Only God Forgives.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah.
That's what I mean.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But again, like, there's no fucking evidence.
No, it's a lot of like, you know.
Inference.
Like Kubrick is the exact same, where people just want to believe, and it's kind of cool because it's like, you'd like to think that those people who do those jobs, like directing, are on that level of intelligence, and that's why we're not all doing it. But you realize, no, it's a job. They're just putting like A, B, C, D in a row and eventually getting good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, like, I said this on our friend Brian and James podcast, who lent us this equipment that we're using today.
Yeah, big shout out. Brian and James fuck each other. Yeah. You can find them on a whole social media channel. It's at Brian and James fuck each other.
Is that really the name of the show?
Oh, that's the name of the show. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Fair play.
Yeah. It's not doing them any favors, but it's honest.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, good for them. Yeah.
You say that, but they got a new listener and a Patreon member last week, a subscriber last week, because someone said they went on SoundCloud, typed in fuck.
Oh, yeah.
That popped up, and they started listening and liked it.
Yeah.
So, like, direct marketing just for.
Yeah.
Fuck.
I saw someone left them a positive review there the other day, and they'd asterisked out fuck in their own review. See, this, if you're listening to that podcast, then you're afraid to type fuck on the internet. I don't know who this person is. But Brian was telling me, I made the same joke about The Shining on their podcast, and Brian was saying someone wrote in to like complain. But because this is the famous thing in The Shining where like none of the architecture lines up.
Makes sense.
It doesn't make sense. And everyone's like, wow, beautiful. Kubrick, what an auteur. But if I directed a film, they'd be like, this man's a fucking idiot. He doesn't know who he is.
Yeah, it's like, oh, that doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. That window shouldn't be there. And it's like, oh, no, I did it on purpose because the house is magic or whatever. And then someone write into Brian and James be like, it's actually because the house is haunted. It's like,
I got it.
Yeah. But, I don't know what the point of that was.
No, but I mean, I think in terms of Excalibur, like, it's the sort of thing of, like, how many of the decisions made in this film were done on purpose and how much of it was just John Borman like, fuck it, just do it that way.
Yeah. And he swung for the fences much more in one direction, and you got to respect it, but I'd also say I wouldn't bother watching it unless you're very bored.
Like, if you're watching it, like, you're making a big commitment. A big commitment. Like,
there was never a director's cut. I'd like to see the extra 40 minutes to see if it made more, like,
narrative
sense.
God, I don't know. What?
In my head then as well, I think, like, maybe that extra 40 minutes is just the sex scene for his daughter. It's just that. And then the dancing.
His other daughter gets a sex scene and the son. But I think that was before we started recording, but you were saying there was a sort of behind the scenes documentary made of it as well.
Neil Jordan did it.
Yes, yeah. So what Neil Jordan worked as a
cinematographer.
Cinematographer on it. And then that's been released, I think.
There was a documentary, I think, in like 2013, I want to say.
Yeah.
And a lot of the footage that was made from that documentary and that Neil Jordan did was used in this one. But, I mean, I saw the Neil Jordan one and it's basically just like, you know, as they're doing stuff, he just whacks up a camera and just takes a few... and then there's a couple of on-set interviews. Like, it's nothing, there's nothing terribly revealing about it. The one that was done in 2013 that had, like, retrospective interviews with, like, Alan Mirren and John Borman and Liam Neeson and all these guys, like, that's a lot more kind of telling about it.
Okay.
And, you know, it's interesting, like, because they all have different kind of memories of it. Like, Helen Mirren talks about how she was, like, you can see she doesn't have terribly fond memories of it.
Right.
And she's not afraid to kind of acknowledge that it wasn't a great set.
Yeah.
Which is fair.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Liam Neeson or Ciarán Hinds, I think, are both, maybe it's the two of them, both of them like, sure, look, you know, it was young and silly and sure, it was their first job and weren't we glad to be there kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Whereas Helen Mirren was like, no, it was a really tough set. And,
yeah. Well, she didn't get to, she had to like actually, like Liam Neeson just showed up and Ciarán Hinds is just like,
totally.
Arthur, Merlin, you bastard.
So Pierce Brosnan auditioned for the role of Ciarán Hinds.
Yeah.
So and he said it went very badly. And, so it was like fine or whatever. So he wasn't like bitter about it. But maybe that's where he gets his taffin.
Maybe you shot me living
here. He's like, Borman, I can get him on.
Out Borman.
That's what I've been missing. That's what's been keeping me out of the big time. Lots of shouting. You know, I've never actually seen Taffin.
It's on our list. I haven't seen it either. I've seen that clip a million times.
Yeah. That's the only bit of it I've seen. I've never seen anything else in it.
It's going to be great. I know that. Because if that's the one scene, there's no way that the director slipped and just allowed that to happen. The whole film's like that.
Yeah.
I've convinced myself of it.
I'm almost getting worried about this film club idea because we've been doing up a list of films to watch.
Yeah.
And like most of them are shit.
Yes.
You can tell already.
That they're shit or aren't shit?
Are shit.
Oh, are shit. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, it is okay. But then again, like, I need to go back into watching more films now. But
like, I would say,
to sit down and watch a full 2.5 hour film is a rare opportunity to have the time to do it now. And then you do that and to watch a film you know you're not going to like.
Yeah, you know it's going to be bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, you really have to force yourself, don't you?
Yeah.
Like, you really have to, like, there's a real discipline to watching shit films. Like, when I'm reviewing stuff, even when I know it's going to be like, I saw Uncharted last week.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, this is the thing. Like, it was like, we were being shown it the day before it was being released. And the...
Oh, so you know it's bad.
Oh, that's like, from entertainment.ie. But like, when I used to come in and say, oh, that film's not going to be released until tomorrow, but the screening is today. It's like... Already, I don't even need to I don't need to bring any notes with me. I know this film is going to be shit.
Because they're just not giving you any
time. Because they are not giving... They are giving me so little time to do anything with it.
To say how bad it is.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Like, the difference between that to like what getting to see it like a few weeks in advance and getting a link to a screener online so you could rewatch it and make notes versus being like, you can have it 4 hours before it's released.
Yeah, totally. Like, and the Uncharted as well. It was like, when I came in, it was like... The embargo was 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. I was like, so release day. We can't put a review up until the day of release. Mm-hmm. And then what was gas was...
Like 10 p.m. day of release.
Yeah.
Let's get that one day first.
Let us have this and then can go after it.
But then like the very next day, I was being shown a film like a month and a half before it was due to be released. And it was a really, really big film. And like, you know, it just... You can always tell... from one or the other, but like, yeah, watching a film that you know is going to be bad, like there is such a discipline in it, like you really have to like force yourself into it, like, so
I got to see I can't remember what the fuck it was called, but Liam Neeson played a tree in it.
A Monster Calls
Well, I used to live down beside the Three Arena and the cinema, they built that shopping
center, the Odeon complex.
The whole like ghost shopping center complex was built for the boom times. And
it's
all
still
the
there.
Yeah,
it's still empty.
There's more stuff in it now. At least there's restaurants and stuff down the bottom. Well, more like when I was living there, it was you walked up three sets of escalators to get to the Odeon past like painted pictures of shops. Like, this is what will happen someday.
It's still there though. Like, all that's there now is like there's a Starbucks, and then there's an Eddie Rockets.
And I would have killed for a Starbucks and Eddie Rockets when I was out there.
In my time,
it was a fucking ghost town. But we went up. They used to do a thing where, like, maybe on a Tuesday, you pay a fiver and you'd see a film that. Yeah, you didn't know what it was going to be, but it was a pre-release.
Yeah, Secret
Cinema.
Secret Cinema
screening. So we went in to see that. It was great. And that's a film I never would have seen of my own volition.
Yeah.
And myself and my housemate went in. The two of us, well, I'm not going to speak for him, but I know I was like hastily trying to cover up my tears before the lights came on.
That film was
fucking stupid, was it?
My memory of that cinema is going to the Fast and the Furious 6 or 7, which is the one when Vin Diesel jumps across the highway.
Yeah.
And is that 7? Because I got a standing ovation going. Because it was me and my friend Ben were like, when it happened and it landed and everything was okay, we're like, if we both stand up and start clapping, people...
Did it work?
Yeah. Like, obviously, not everyone's going to join in, but a lot of people have clapped sitting down, and then a couple of lads around, you could see, yes, respect.
Yeah.
We're all giving this what
appreciate
it deserves.
Yeah, good call.
We saw it in the trailer. It's better. It brought us to the film. That's why we're here.
Yeah.
And we saw it, and it's great.
Yeah.
But... sure, we may wrap up because I think we're probably touching 2 hours. Yeah, I think now.
It was
a good crack. This is almost as long as Excalibur.
Sorry.
Really enjoyed that. Well, how would you rate it? You didn't say your feelings on it.
I enjoyed it. I have a good Roger Ebert quote. He gave it 2.5 stars. I'd go as far as 3.
Yeah,
right.
Because it's
fun in its madness. But he said, Excalibur is a record of the comings and goings of arbitrary, inconsistent, shadowy figures who are not heroes but simply giants run amok. Still, it's wonderful to look at.
Yeah. Fair. Yeah. Fair. That's very fair, yeah.
Yeah.
That's fair. Like, I'd give it a 3 out of 5. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's got huge problems, but it looks incredible and sounds incredible. That's enough.
So many classes. I remember one scene, I don't know, there's just the gates to Camelot. There's so many bits that they just didn't have to put in.
Mm.
There's just scenes where, like, yeah, they're walking in the gate and it looks class. You never see it again. And it was, you know, pointless for the story. But they were just building amazing sets.
Just for the sake of this looks great. We want to have this, yeah.
I think there is an old saying like that. I don't know what director has it, but like every shot in a film needs to be, like, your director needs to be able to explain why it's happening and what part like it plays in the story.
Sure.
But one of those excuses can be because it's fucking cool.
Yeah.
Like, because it looks awesome or sounds great. All right, yeah, cool.
Cool.
And there's a lot of that here.
Oh, a lot of that. Like, I'd say that's 60% of it nearly. Like. Yeah.
Now, do you have anything you want to plug before we leave?
No. I mean, I don't know.
You can go check out his Uncharted review.
Twitter, I guess. Brian M. Lloyd, I guess.
That's probably it.
Yeah, sweet. So cheers, Brian. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Excellent. We'll chat to you soon.
Shafter.